Morning, everyone. Good afternoon, everyone. Gonna go ahead and get started here today. So today we're doing the course on sex disaggregation and dreams data. Jenny, who presented a couple weeks ago, is gonna take us through that. But before we get started, I just wanted to check in on course logistics and whether there are any issues that people have been still having. We are still getting through on catching up on a few assignments that people have submitted and I haven't had a chance to grade yet. So I'll be getting those back to people today. Any assignments that you haven't received comments on yet, I will get back today. If you're behind on assignments, please do start getting them in soon so we can keep up. One thing logistically for next week, because next week is the virtual International AIDS Conference, we're gonna actually take next week off and we're just gonna delay everything an additional week. David and I are actually presenting over this period next week. And then also with all of the webinars that everybody is gonna be participating in as part of the virtual International AIDS Conference. We think it might be a little bit much to try and do another session of the course next week. So we'll be back in 2 weeks from today. So the 15th, I believe that is. So before we move on, any questions that people are having? Walter, I see you saying your status keeps saying you're not enrolled. I'll look at your registration on Engage during the presentation here and see if I can figure out what's going on there. Okay, so this week, we're sort of moving, you know, the last 2 weeks have been our section on community-led monitoring. And now this week we're transitioning into a couple of weeks where we're looking at population data and specific population data. And we sort of introduced this concept initially back in week one where we talk about bias and representativity of data. And here we're gonna start looking at, you know, how when we get disaggregated data and the importance of disaggregated data to interpretation and to programmatic interpretation and how we think about what programs need to be in place and what interventions need to be in place. So that's what we're doing this week. 2 weeks from now, we'll be doing similar around key populations programming and getting data on key populations. So with that, I'm gonna turn it over to Jenny.
Great. Thanks, Brian. Let me just share my screen. Hi, morning, afternoon. Okay, is that working?
Yep, that's working.
Great. Perfect, great. So good to see you all again. I'm Jenny, as Brian mentioned, working with Brian Austin in the policy office in DC. And today, going to go through some considerations for how to include sex and gender data collection, gender analysis, and some other considerations for sex and gender in data collection and reporting. So the first section of the presentation is about why it matters, what's sex, what's gender, why it matters, and how to include in our data collection tools. So my first question is, what is the difference between sex and gender?
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, so sex and gender. Let me begin with the sex. I'll define sex as the biological or anatomy or physiological anatomy. So you may be either currently in our world, especially in Malawi, we have two binaries, male and female. While gender will be defined at the, as a socially constructed something that is socially or culturally constructed. So depending on the culture, you may be treated as male or female. So this is something that imposes on us as people, as individuals.
Perfect. Yes, that's an excellent description. Thank you. I just put that here in more writing, which is exactly what was just said, which is that sex refers to biological differences, meaning genitalia, chromosomal differences, and gender will refer to the more socially prescribed roles that we are given as people in societies, which definitely influences our identities and our behaviors, the jobs we take, all of that sort of stuff is wrapped up in gender. And I put up just a comic here as, you know, sort of a joke, but this sort of represents the difference in that the one person on the screen is asking, who doesn't have a baby, is asking, oh, is it a boy or a girl? Clearly asking, what's the sex of your child, boy or girl? And the other person responds, I don't know, it can't talk yet. Clearly saying, we don't know its gender because it hasn't grown up to tell us if it's male or female. So just to start things off about why it matters so much to think about sex and gender in HIV data, especially, and in the work that we do, I just have a few examples and a few motivating examples to talk through. The first here is the story of Caprisa 004, which you all may know about, but was a randomized trial to test the efficacy of a 1% tenofovir gel used for HIV prevention in women in South Africa. And the gel found that there was mild, not mild, about a 40%, 35% reduction in HIV incidence among users of the gel, which wasn't the home run we were hoping for, but had, was promising in some ways. They did find that according to adherence, women who reported and were seen to use the gel more got more protection than less. What was missing to this original story was that we missed a key piece of what was influencing women's adherence or thought to be adherence. There was, after this trial, there was sort of a discussion around, well, women's adherence might be lower than men. We're seeing some really low adherence here to this gel. Maybe gels are not an appropriate prevention technology. Women maybe don't want to use them as much. You know, something's going on because adherence is kind of low. We later did a secondary analysis. By we, I mean these smart researchers, but they did a secondary data analysis to look at and found that actually women who had non-lactobacillic vaginal microbiomes, those bacteria in the microbiome were actually eating the tenofovir gel, and they were degrading the tenofovir gel at a faster rate than those women with lactobacillic dominant microbiomes. And that was affecting the ability of the drug to build up and protect women from HIV. And so actually what we assumed to be a gender difference, perhaps, in who was adhering to the gel and whether or not it was acceptable for women was in part based in a sex difference, in that people who are having vaginal sex and have microbiomes that are non-lactobacillic were actually having a biological reason why the drug wasn't working as opposed to a gender reason. And we would have missed a key part of this puzzle if we hadn't looked for these sex differences in addition to gender differences in adherence. The other thing I want to mention here is that just on PrEP adherence and on sex and gender, is that the inverse can absolutely happen too, where we may assume that something is a sex difference and that we're, and when it's actually a gender difference. And the example that I'll use is in PrEP efficacy and how well PrEP is working for a population, we may assume that men who have sex with men or MSM and transgender women might have similar PrEP efficacy if the major reason that they are at risk is because of anal sex. However, we have seen throughout research that many of the reasons that determine a transgender woman's PrEP efficacy is actually if she is treated with gender-affirming care, if she's treated as a woman when she goes to seek care. And that if she's treated as a gay man, she might be deterred from services and not want to take PrEP. And that doesn't have anything to do with her sex or her biological risk for HIV, and everything to do with her gender and how she's treated in clinical services. So those are just two sort of motivating examples to help us start to think about the role of sex and gender and how that's influencing our HIV programs. So I have just a few little examples here. And I was hoping that we could say and discuss if you think that this is mainly a gender issue, if this is mainly a sex issue, or if it's both. So the first one is, in most countries in the world, women who are living with HIV are more likely to be accessing ARV treatment than men. Do you think this is a gender issue, a sex issue, or both?
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, this is Eric. Going by that statement, I think in my view, when we talk of women, when we are talking about gender, at the same time, we are also, when it comes to accessing treatment, I would say, yeah, in this case we are talking about gender.
Great.
Because we are comparing men versus women.
Right. Yeah. That's my view too, is that here the reasons that men and women access treatment differently have to do with who's more likely to go to healthcare services, and men are notoriously have sort of lower health-seeking behavior and go to clinic a little bit less. Part of that is because women become pregnant, they maybe seek treatment or seek care during pregnancy times, and so there could be an argument to be made that because women get pregnant, they may be more likely to go to care. But I agree with you. I think this is gender. Number two, studies have shown that women who are taking the ARV with dolutegravir are more likely to gain weight than men. Is this a sex issue or a gender issue? Oh, Brian, did someone raise their hand or chat? Sorry.
Nelson, go ahead. We've also got two answers in the chat. Okay. So Ken says, no, the second one is a sex issue, as does Chipo.
Great. Yes, perfect. Exactly. I think these are sex issues as well, having to do with the biological reasons why men and women gain weight. Okay, and thank you so much for the last one. In sub-Saharan Africa, young women on average are twice as likely to be diagnosed with HIV than men of the same age. Do you think that this is sex or gender? Or both?
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, I think my take is that now in that case, the last one is it wears both caps. There is a sex issue and a gender part. So to begin with the gender part, so we are talking of young women and men, where now the bigger picture there, or the part of the equation, is the gender imbalance that occurs between young women and men. In this case, I should assume that these are older men. Naturally, when it comes to gender issues, you are talking of the relationship that exists between the two groups, men and women. And in this case, women are disempowered. And when it comes to HIV, you find that women, especially young women, may not have that power to, let's say, to encourage, let's say, a man to use a condom because of the power differences that exist. And then the sex part is because of issues to do with the vaginal makeup, where a girl is more exposed, or a woman is more exposed to HIV than a man. Yeah.
Right. Thank you. Yeah. No. That's exactly right. Thank you. That's exactly right, and that's. That's what I put down here, gender, sex, and then both for the other one, taking into consideration both biological predispositions to HIV with receptive sex, and then also gender and power issues. Thank you. Perfect. The next, there's just three sections of this presentation, and the second one here is going to be on sort of the basics around conducting a gender analysis and some practical considerations for us before we get into some more of the PEPFAR specific data. So the first thing that I'll say around a gender analysis and the importance of collecting and the importance of sort of taking this lens to all of our work, the first step, if we're going to be analyzing data by sex and by gender, is that we have to firstly include people of multiple sexes and multiple genders in our research. And this study was from 2016. It was just a review of all of the trials that they that reported data by sex, and they found that still in 2016, only about 20% of participants in ARV studies were women, 38% in vaccine studies were women, and only 11% of women of participants in HIV cure studies were women. And so just at the very beginning of all of this, we really do need to think about who we're including in our studies and why, and if we are including enough women, enough transgender women, enough people of different sexes and genders in order to know enough about their bodies to make good decisions. So collecting data on sex and gender may seem sort of straightforward, but it can be really complicated. And I put up here some examples of the types of questions that that could be asked to ascertain biological sex versus gender. And I do this knowing that these do come from like a research center in Boston in the United States. And so it might not always be possible to collect data in the same way and ask the same types of questions about gender in all settings. But I put these up here just, you know, as something to think about in data collection, if it's possible to get both and safe for participants to get both kinds of answers, that it is something of importance. And so sort of the gold standard that we think about when we're collecting sex and gender is to ask, what sex were you assigned at birth? To get at someone's biological sex, and then asking what is your current gender identity. And so very possibly someone could be assigned female at birth and still identify as female. You'll probably get the majority of participants who are non-transgender, who are cisgender. But I, you know, there's also this possibility and probability that a proportion of samples will certainly be transgender men and women, and including them and disaggregating by that is an important step. So I put these questions up here for your consideration. You know, I think that you know, as data collection and the world start, you know, continues to change, that leaving, not asking about gender will be more of a disservice than including those questions. So, yeah. So the second step here after in a gender analysis, and the way that I think about it, is that after we've included women, it's not only about including people of multiple sexes and genders in our studies and collecting that data. We also have to disaggregate and analyze data by sex and gender. It's not enough to just have that data, but actually presenting it and making the data available by sex and gender is important. This is just a screenshot of the UNAIDS AIDS info platform showing progress towards 90% or the percentage of people living with HIV that know their status who are women. And so you're able to find some sex disaggregated data for treatment numbers and cascades and things through some of these global resources. The third part of a gender analysis for me, after you do the collection and you analyze by sex and gender, the third part is really taking a gender equity lens to looking at data in general. What I do when I look at any data, I look at any study, I think to myself, okay, where are the women? Where are the men? What's different? What's equal? What's unequal? And really try to think about that in all the data that I look at. And gender in this way, gender equity, and what I'm talking about here, but when I say equity, it's about the fairness of treatment for men and women, but it has to do with their outcomes. So it doesn't say that we have to treat men and women exactly equal, because they might need different things. But what we really do seek is that our programs and our policies work equally for men and women, that both of them benefit equally, even if we give different things to men and women based on their needs. So another example here, just to illustrate this point, is the story of dolutegravir in women of childbearing age. You all, you know, probably know this story well, but in brief, dolutegravir, as was beginning, science was developing to show that it was a good drug and a good option for viral suppression and lower side effect profiles. There was also a signal of potential increases of fetal abnormalities among women who were taking the drug during the first trimester of pregnancy. As we developed more data, we really did see that signal very much declined. but there was still, there was like some policy ramifications of that early data where governments and countries put in place either restrictions, eligibility restrictions that excluded women from getting the drug, or put in additional requirements such as contraception. Despite the WHO saying that dolutegravir should be available to women of reproductive age, of childbearing age, with informed consent, obviously, but without condition on these other things. So I've been searching really to try to find data on sex disaggregated data for who gets DTG, and I haven't been able to find great sources. But let's say that I did find, and actually, so I was in the COPS Côte d'Ivoire room last year, and there was a little bit of this data being discussed about men and women who was getting DTG. So it is really relevant for PEPFAR and COPS discussions. But let's say that I did find a country where 50% of people on DTG were women and 50% were men. And I would look at that data and I would ask myself, is this gender equity? For me, the two things that I think here when I look at data like that is, one, what's the background risk? So is this gender equity? Is 50-50 fair? The answer would be probably no. In most countries in the world, women are more than 50% of people living with HIV. And so if 50% of your DTG users are women, then you're still not quite reaching equity. And second, it's important to think about what the other barriers that may be in place for women to get DTG in these settings that are not being captured in that 50-50 statistic. So for example, if that woman, in order to get DTG, has to pay for contraception out of pocket, had to make multiple appointments and travel to multiple clinics in order to get that contraception, and maybe she had to negotiate contraception with her partner to begin with in order to get that prescription, to get contraception, or to get on DTG. And so what's not captured in that 50-50 statistic, which might look like equity on its face, if you dig deeper, start to see the extra barriers that are in place for women, meaning that DTG wouldn't be equally as accessible to men and women based on these other criteria. So that's what I mean when I say a gender equity lens, and is something that I think is important to keep in mind when looking at all studies and all data. So I have just another sort of example set and that I'd love to discuss with you all. The first is in Washington, D.C., so it's known that both men and women suffer from violence victimization in Washington, D.C., where Brian Austin and I live. And so policymakers have decided to build two shelters for victims of violence, one for men and one for women. Do you think that this is gender equitable? And what might you change to make Washington's violence response more equitable?
Hello.
Hello.
So that one, looking at, anyway, I'm thinking of Washington, D.C., quite different from Africa, in the sense that in Africa, you notice that issues to do with gender were another face. But I think going by that question, I think yes, whosoever came up with that proposal had an aspect of trying to make things okay, had was working from the background of making it acceptable, in the sense that he felt there was need to build two shelters, one specifically for men, and one specifically for women. But then probably now, getting back to the second bit of the question, what might you change to make Washington's violence response more equitable? I think there will be need. You notice that when you look at literature on gender, women tend to, seek, or they will rush to institutions that would, come in to assist them. Or women, men are the perpetrators. So when it comes to issues of let's say, gender abuse, men oftentimes are perpetrators, and women are oftentimes victims. So, yeah, of course, there are times you find that men may be also victims, but largely it's women who are victims when it comes to gender-related violence. So, for me, making it more equitable was to make sure that not only having two shelters, but issues to do with the psychosocial support, especially with the relation to the specific shelter for women. I think whosoever should do that must ensure that women are oftentimes victims, and there should be everything in place to ensure that whosoever is referred to that shelter for women is able, or not only is not only safe, but there are also other safety measures in place to cushion them from the issues that are oftentimes
right.
as a result of gender abuse.
Perfect. Yeah, I think that's right. I heard a few different things in there. So, one being that it's good to recognize that men and women might have different needs when it comes to violence support services. And so having a shelter for men and having a shelter for women that's able to cater to their needs would be really important. So that's a good thing. And then a second thing being that women are the primary victims of intimate partner violence. So you do find many more women might need help than men. And so you might want to have more beds and a bigger shelter, or two shelters for women and one shelter for men, based on need, because you might just find that there are just more women who need violence support services than men. And so we might need to put more resources into making that bigger, even though it would be good to have a shelter for men. Great, thank you. And then one more here. A new health clinic was built in Johannesburg that will have lots of new equipment and laboratory capacity. However, the clinic will specialize in adult care only, and the clinic asks that you don't bring your children with you when you come for services. Do you think that this is gender equitable, and what might you change? Nelson, I think you raised your hand.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
This is not gender equitable, and I think that the issue that could be considered on make changes that they can also build a new clinic basically on the young children in order to be saving for both of those categories in the society. Thank you.
Yeah, I would agree with you too. I think that women in almost every society in the world are the primary. Oh, we got Chippo. Did you raise your hand? You welcome, Joan Ben.
Maybe just add on. For me, it would mean that if I am a woman and I
Chibo, can you get closer to your mic?
Okay. Hello, can you hear me now?
Barely. You're very quiet.
Okay. Babe, let me type my contribution.
Great. Yeah. So just while we're waiting for people to type, I would agree that this wouldn't be gender equitable. Right, exactly. This is what I was going to say. Chibo, thank you so much. Yeah, women take care of kids. Women are the primary caregivers of children in almost every society in the world. And so if you have a clinic that specializes in adults and focuses on adults but doesn't allow children, it might look equitable on its face. But you're like, well, no one can bring children, so it's fair. But actually, if women have to take care of kids all day and they have nowhere to put the kids while they go get care, you might inadvertently be excluding women from accessing services because they can't bring their children with them. So thank you. And you know, these last two slides in this section are really just for your reference and for tools. The WHO and others have put together sort of these scales and assessments for how to think about if our programs are gender equitable and how we might want to move them towards being more equitable. And really, the top line takeaway, you know, there's a lot of words and a lot of very specific language that they use. But the top line takeaway here is that we want our programs to not only differentiate between men and women. It's a good start to differentiate between men and women and disaggregate data and think about different needs for different people. But the ultimate goal is to try to make the world more equitable by addressing the root causes of that inequity. And later in the presentation, when we talk about dreams, it's an example of a program which not only attempts to look at women and men and disaggregate, but to also address some of those root causes of what puts young women at risk of HIV. So that's sort of just the main takeaway here. And here's the WHO gender assessment tool. There's some links here to some tools which are sort of like guiding questions and exercises that you can go through when you're thinking about designing your own programming to try to think about if there's ways to make your programming more gender responsive. Great. So this last section here is on sex and gender considerations in PEPFAR data. And Brian, Austin, please feel free to jump in as we go through this. So I guess I should pause. Are there questions about those previous sections on sex and gender and equality and equity and other things before we pivot to PEPFAR?
Yes, thank you. This is Eric again from Malawi.
Great, hi.
Wow. When I look at, you notice that when it comes to HIV, there are gender issues in HIV. But my experience in working in HIV programming for the last 10, 12 years is that much as you notice that...
Eric, you got very quiet. Can you get by your
yes.
mic?
Hello. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes, I was saying that when you look at
most of our HIV programs, you do not see that they do not focus much on gender issue. Much as you notice that when it comes to HIV prevalence, it is also contributed by gender aspect. But mm-hmm. there is little that countries do in ensuring that they are dealing with gender issues, except for maybe PEPFAR program, which I also feel that even when you look at PEPFAR programming, the six layers, they do not focus on men, and yet men are the perpetrators. There's a lot of transactional sex, intergenerational sex, and yet for PEPFAR program, it only focuses on girls. It only focuses on the part which is disempowered, and yet mm-hmm. I feel if we are to deal with this, we also need to deal with men as well, change their attitude and other issues, and in that way we are going to slow down the spread of HIV.
Yeah, you know, I absolutely could not agree more, and thank you for saying that. I think that that you bring up a really good point, which is that every person has a gender and it influences how we behave and what we do and our risks. It's not just young women who have gender. Oftentimes young women's gender puts them at risk for lots of things, but men also have a gender, and that gender contributes to violence perpetration. It can contribute to lower access to treatment and lots of things that can really influence the dynamics of a country and HIV and programming. And so you're right. And my, you know, my opinion is that gender programming can't just be this siloed thing where we make programs for young women, we give them to young women, and that's our only gender programming. We just think we checked a box. In fact, we need to think about gender in all of our programming, in our treatment programs, in our prevention programs, across the board, in order to really address this, which is, I think, exactly what you brought up. And so, yeah, I really appreciate that.
And I would just add, I think, you know, this is a really important point. I think, you know, thinking about it, oftentimes part of the way PEPFAR approaches this and part of the way programs approach this is they go to the easiest access point, right? And so there's this historical problem, which Jenny has already sort of mentioned, which is we have more women who end up accessing the healthcare services that we already have, right? Either because we have women get pregnant and so access services related to antenatal care, or family planning service things like that men typically don't access. And so we build our programming around that. And so we've decided, oh, okay, so let's focus on women because those are the ones that we have access to, right? And it further entrenches this problem where we're not actually addressing the challenges and the issues around getting men to access services and getting men to use prevention services and things like that. And so it creates this inequity that places all of the burdens more and more on women than on men to end up accessing, to be the controllers of HIV for the community in general. And it's part of this just historical legacy of we went for the easiest population.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, Brian. And, you know, and I think as, you know, as we kind of look ahead on what's on the horizon for, you know, PEPFAR, we have seen some recognition that men need to be addressed, and there's been pushes But a lot of outstanding questions about how we're going to do it. You know, recognizing that men need sort of gender-specific services as the first step, but you know, where to find them and how to engage them or continues to be an issue almost everywhere. And so I think that looking for new research and programming breakthroughs for men will be a really important part of this next phase of PEPFAR. So, great. Thank you. And feel free to raise your hand or chime up if there's other things you want to say or discuss as we go through here. I'm now keeping an eye on the hand raising. So thank you for doing that. Great. On the idea of sex and age segregation and PEPFAR data, I will say, so in, you know, internally PEPFAR does collect age and sex disaggregated data for most indicators, but they are not all publicly accessible. And so the ones around HIV testing and treatment related absolutely are, but many of them are not. And you can find here on the Panorama dashboard, which is linked here, you can go and see what level of age and sex disaggregation is collected and available for each indicator if you have interest into digging into this. Another good place to find data and to find age or sex segregated data is on our MER database, which is linked here. And actually under our trends section, you'll, for each of these indicators, you can find sex segregated data. So I just took some screenshots of how of where to find this section, taking South Africa as an example. I'm sure you all have seen this or used the database by this point in the course. But where you would find this is on our homepage here at mer.amfor.org. You would select your country, say you select South Africa.
I do want to interject here real quick, Jenny.
Yeah,
and just
please.
Say to the Malawi folks, unfortunately, this doesn't work for Malawi. The PEPFAR's release of the sex disaggregated data for Malawi is not at the district level. They only release it at the sort of regional level. And that's just a problem with the way PEPFAR releases data for Malawi. So it's only Malawi and Ethiopia that we don't have these sex disaggregated data for.
Thank you, Brian. Yeah, and actually, when I was originally doing this presentation, I chose Malawi as my example. Emailed Brian being like, it doesn't work. But he unfortunately told me that Malawi, the data isn't available. So something to push for. So in this example, selecting South Africa, once you select South Africa, you'll be taken to the country specific page. You can click on indicators, trends, and performance, which is one of those tabs, and select the indicator that you want to take a look at. I wanted to take a look at treatment new. I wanted to look at newly enrolled on treatment. Are we enrolling more men, more women? So I selected that. And I scrolled down and looked at these tabs, and then I clicked the middle tab, disaggregate by sex, and the bar chart popped into a sex disaggregated bar chart showing females in sort of the red color and males in the lavender purplish color. And I just highlighted 2018 Q4 here, where I can see that about 180,000 women were enrolled new on treatment in 2018 Q4, and about 94,000 men. So definitely a sex or gender probably gender difference here between men and women. You can also go back up to the top on the map and select a district, as Brian was just saying, to look at sex disaggregated data within a district. I went to the top and selected a district in South Africa, and automatically my graph down below will show the sex disaggregated data by district for this district. And when I look at the same quarter, I see that about 4,800 women were enrolled and 2,200 men were enrolled on treatment. And so very similar proportions and gender disparity as we saw at the national level. But I may be able to look through some districts where more men are being enrolled or the numbers are more equal, and be able to ask some questions around why some districts maybe are doing better jobs at enrolling men, and what they might be doing that can be helpful lessons learned. Just a chat from colleague in Malawi saying they need to take advantage of the new government to push for sex disaggregated data from the community to national level, and definitely agree. Lastly here, just to mention that PEPFAR does have a few, what I would say gender-related irrelevant indicators. There's not that many, and here are two that I end up looking at and using despite some of the limitations, but are important. The first is GEND GBV, which is the number of people receiving post-violence-based clinical care based on this minimum package. And so you can see the number of GBV of clients who are accessing those services through PEPFAR. And the second is a family planning integration indicator, which is the number of HIV service delivery points at a site which are supported by PEPFAR that are providing integrated voluntary family planning services either on site or by referral. So there's some limitations to these, but it's what's available currently. And you can find their full descriptions here in the MER reference guide, which I've linked here below. So just briefly on the DREAMS program, I know we're running out of time here. The DREAMS program, I'm sure you know all familiar with it, and sort of the structure, and you know, as I mentioned earlier, it is an example of a program that is aimed at HIV prevention among women and is young women and is delivering services to try to address the root causes of inequities in HIV prevalence, not only sort of just distributing condoms or doing something more surface level. They actually try to engage families and community members and partners and other people that, given the power differentials between young women and other community members, try to engage sort of whole neighborhoods and whole communities in HIV prevention and sort of this socio-ecological or sort of model to try to prevent HIV among young women. So, has been an important transition in the kinds of way that PEPFAR is doing programming. How this is going to be monitored and how this we can look and see if this is working. There's another indicator, PEPFAR indicator called AGYW-PREV, which is the percentage of adolescent girls and young women that complete at least the DREAMS primary package of evidence-based services or interventions. So we can take a look at this in the MER guide. Again, is the full description, but we can take a look at this to see some indication of the number of clients and young women who are accessing the DREAMS package. There's also some external evaluations which are underway. The two primary ones, they're Gates funded. There's some implementation science research studies, so really focused on how well the program is working, or you know, the process indicators, how well they're enrolling people, what are some primary data collection points, trying to learn about how well DREAMS is being implemented. So that's taking place in these countries here. And the Population Council does make a few of these data sets actually publicly available to download, to take a look at the data yourselves. And those are available here. I've linked to the Pop Council website. Also, Gates is also funding an impact evaluation, which is going to be led or is led by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And this evaluation is really focused on the questions, are we reducing incidence in young women? Are the goals that we set for the program actually being met? And they're going to have control groups and intervention groups and really doing more of an impact evaluation where we can try to see if our programming is working as well as we hope. So just some resources here to take a look at DREAMS, and there's obviously a ton more information, but this is just in brief. So I was hoping to sort of leave us with a little discussion. I know we're out of time, so it might be cut short, but just a little discussion about disaggregated data, you know, just sort of reflecting on what the whole presentation was on today, what the risks are if we don't disaggregate our data and what that can mean for women, for men, for our programming. And then also, what else do you want to see from PEPFAR in relation to sex and gender data? What would you want to push them to do better at? So I'd like to just open it up for conversation. If we just have like maybe 5 minutes here, Brian, or not.
Yep.
Okay.
And I think it's important for us to think about this in the context of the community-led monitoring efforts as well, of how we're going to think about sex and gender disaggregation within the community-led monitoring efforts that we're going to be involved in. I see Eric is unmuted, then I've got David's hand. And then Chipo is talking about viral load data from looking for viral load data from PEPFAR.
Yes, thank you, Brian. Yes, my quick reaction is that I would want, as I said earlier on in my comment, you'll notice that in PEPFAR data, as I said, the emphasis is focused on the AGYW. And of course, lately people are talking about the adolescents, boys and young men, but it's only lately. So my interest is to begin to see the adolescents, boys and young men data. It would be good than only focusing on girls and women who oftentimes bear the brunt of gender inequality. Yeah, so I would want to see that. From now onwards, PEPFAR programs should also begin to focus on men, begin to focus on young men, changing their perception, their understanding about HIV, about gender equality and gender inequality, and begin to appreciate that their actions tend to put more girls at risk. And in this case, if we continue to do that, then there's no way we'll end AIDS come 2030. Thank you.
David?
Thank you. Yeah, good afternoon. I think basically I just wanted to respond to the first question. I think basically it would lead to non-equity programming. So like Eric was just saying, we may be misinvesting, investing in the wrong areas and will not be able to see the desired results at the end. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a great answer. It's certainly, if we don't disaggregate and we don't know who's missing, we don't have any shot at fixing it. And so it's really the first step to knowing what's going on and understanding some of these sex and gender differences. Other comments about maybe what we would wanna see, what else we would wanna see relevant for sex and gender in PEPFAR? Viral load data, Brian, what's the status with sex and gender and viral load data? What do we have?
So right now the PEPFAR is not releasing the viral load data by sex and clearly not gender because none of the gender related data are really released at all. Mm-hmm. So there's only sex data that's available. And there's not sex data for viral load. So it is something that may be coming. We have had conversations with PEPFAR about improving the disaggregations of the data that are being released. And this was one of the ones that we specifically pointed out, because it's really important, right, to think about when we're talking about who's virally suppressed, it's not just a matter of who's virally suppressed at the national level or the total number of people who are virally suppressed. It is also really important how we disaggregate that to the point that David made and Jenny has made about knowing that our viral suppression is occurring, equally across different ages and different sexes and different genders to see if there are program problems, right? Or maybe if we look at the data just as it is here, right, where we're only looking at national level or even district level, but without any age and sex disaggregation, it may be that we're doing really, really well with some populations, and the only people who are having difficulties are people who are facing difficulty accessing services because of their gender, right? And but we're not seeing that. We're not understanding what program implementation is causing that or leading to poor viral load outcomes overall. But there's only one population that we really need to focus on, or there's a couple of different populations that we need to focus on to fix there. But without that disaggregated data, we can't see that.
Just one really quick thing to add. I think it's important to note that a lot of the conversation that we're having right now is about what PEPFAR makes available on the data portal for us and other outside people to take a look at. And one of the reasons that we know we can push them for more is in their MER manual and in the ports and in the COPs, we know that they have finer disaggregated data for virtually everything that they collect information on. So that includes the viral load data and includes prevention programming. And it's somewhere that even if it's not something that we can go and find ourselves from their website, it's something that we can be pushing for so that we can help to answer these questions that we're talking about now. And like Jenny was saying before, like oftentimes on all of the indicators that PEPFAR has or with any program, the first question that we might be asking is where are the women or where are the young people or where are the key pops and trying to zoom into specific groups.
Great. Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you, Austin. I think that we've gone a little over here, and so unless there are other burning questions, and I think a nice way to wrap up, which is bouncing off of Austin's comment, which is how we can use the things we talked about today for advocacy. There's been a few suggestions about interfacing with governments, with programs, with funders to really push for the availability of this data and then use that data to make programs better suited to meet the needs of different people of sex and gender. So Yeah, I think that that might be just about it for me. Unless there are other burning questions, feel free to ask them now or email me, or, you know, I guess we're here every week, so we can always loop back to some things. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone. Just for those who weren't on at the very beginning, circling back, we are going to take next week off because next week is the Virtual International AIDS Conference, and there's probably going to be a lot of webinars going on next week. I know David and I, along with Marie and Luba, are presenting during this time slot next week as part of a workshop. So we're going to take next week off, and then we'll be back in 2 weeks for the webinar on key populations. So next week is a really good option also if you have time and are looking for more to do around the course, either to catch up on assignments or to do some of the supplemental modules that are available on Excel and on some of the other things that we've put there if you want to keep going forward on the course material there. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.